From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for the Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with the Attorney General of Maryland, Brian Frosch, who is up for re-election. We'll also be talking with D.C. at-large Councilmember Alyssa Silverman. But first up, Corey Smedley, Homeland Security and Emergency Manager for the City of Alexandria. He joins us by phone. Corey Smedley, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
The region avoided the worst of the hurricane, but flooding has been a problem in places like Old Town even before the storm. How is Alexandria doing right now?
We're actually faring pretty well. The storm has tracked for us in a positive light. But although, you know, we get out of this storm path, but you know, we prepare for the worst. And some of that preparation helps us to even sustain some of the consequences that a hurricane would bring. So our staff is working around the clock to ensure some of the preparatory things are taking place as it relates to our storm drain maintenance, our arborists working with our trees and ensuring that because we have some our land has been saturated with rain, that even though we're not getting the winds, we still could potentially have some trees down, which would, in fact, hurt us with power outages. So a lot of that work is being done now, and we're still preparing for some of the remnants of what that hurricane could bring, because it's moving pretty slow, so therefore we're going to get some significant rain over the next week or so.
When we do get that rain, are there any kind of resources that you can provide for people who need to protect their businesses and their homes?
So we do have a program in Alexandria through our Transportation and Environmental Services where we distribute sandbags. Obviously, if you go to our website, our Alexandria government website, and go to our Transportation and Environmental Services division, they will have a schedule if, in fact, the Potomac floods, and it warns us to distribute those sandbags. The times and location will be on the website in the event we reach that level.
Finally, what is it about Old Town in particular that makes it so vulnerable to flooding, and how are you approaching long-time flood preparedness in terms of infrastructure improvements or anything else that you can do?
It is the topography. It's right on the waterway. It's a vibrant city that brings a lot of our maritime assets that people enjoy. We are working with our Transportation and Environmental Services, our Planning and Zoning Division, and they know that certain areas within not only Old Town but in Alexandria has some significant flooding concerns. So inherently in every developmental project, there are experts, engineers. We also work with the Army Corps of Engineers to evaluate what are some best preventive and mitigation methods, whether they're doing maintenance with our sewers and drains, whether that's putting up flood walls, or whether that's putting certain water pumps throughout the area to minimize the impact of flooding. The bottom line is at some point when it rains a lot, you're going to get minimal flooding, and we also, one significant part of that is communicating with our public. So we're also working with entities like the Chamber of Commerce to get information out to our business community, as well as our citywide communicators are helping get the message out to our citizens.
Here's Tom Sherwood.
It sounds like you're saying the best you can hope for is better mitigation as opposed to stopping. There's no expectation that at some point the old Alexandria waterfront will be fixed or it won't flood. I mean, you've got a lot of development going on there, but it sounds like you're going to sandbags don't sound like a long-term solution at all. But at some point, will Old Town be not bothered by the floods except for maybe the 100-year flood? I mean, in Ellicott City in Maryland, for example, you know, they're talking about maybe tearing down some buildings or changing some of that horrific development that has created the flood zone for that historic city. Is there a point where Alexandria has to stop building some things or building more flood walls or something? This sounds like mitigation, not fixing.
Absolutely. So luckily for Alexandria, we have not experienced that type of flooding that Ellicott City has, although there are engineers and developers and planners that are looking at long-term goals. Right now, it doesn't warrant some stoppage of development at this point, but that is always in consideration for our development in our city.
Corey Smedley is Homeland Security and Emergency Manager for the City of Alexandria. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
As I said, later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Brian Frosch. He's the Attorney General of Maryland, who is up for re-election. Joining us now in studio is Alyssa Silverman, who's an at-large council member in Washington, D.C. She's an independent who's also running for re-election. Alyssa Silverman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Kojo. Thrilled to be here as always.
And Tom Sherwood, one of the reasons that Alyssa Silverman may be smiling was that one of her major challengers in this race, who was a guest on this broadcast recently, S. Catherine Allen, has abandoned her campaign because the Board of Elections says, well, you cannot be on the ballot because your signatures that that were challenged by Alyssa Silverman turned out to be not legitimate and not sufficient for you to be able to get on the ballot. It seems, according to Fennett Narapil in the Washington Post, that the business community really fumbled this.
Well, let me just say, the city paper also had some stories about it, not just the Washington Post.
This is true.
Certain freelance contributing writer.
Who shall remain nameless, Tom Sherwood?
I think there is terrific press coverage all around.
Here's the deal. Alyssa Silverman has angered, and she's here to defend herself, has upset or angered some parts of the business community about paid family leave, how it's being paid for with a tax, 0.62% tax, not 6%. And so she's gotten into Mayor Tony Williams, the former mayor, former council member David Catania, and others went and searched for a candidate, and they found S. Catherine Allen, who had been the banking commissioner, I think, under Tony Williams back in 1999 or so, and had worked as his neighborhood coordinator in Ward 8.
That's Deanne Reeder.
No, I'm sorry, I got them mixed up. That's right. Thank you very much. It's a good thing you're here.
No problem.
I've been doing so much reporting on this.
You got a lot of notes.
But here's
in front
the deal. The campaign never got off the starting block because the petitions were a disaster. And David Catania and Mayor Tony Williams until now have not really said anything publicly. At the Jeff Bezos big meeting last night, I spoke to Mayor Williams. I went up to him just at two tables away from Bezos, and I said, Mayor, you know, you haven't returned my phone calls, my emails, my text messages. I even staked out the front of his office building one afternoon and to see if I could catch him. And he finally said to me, yes, he basically said the campaign was a disaster. Mayor Williams said that Catherine Allen did not listen to him or to David Catania. He said, you know, after I had that horrible situation with the 2002 campaign, and I had to run as a write-in because my petitions were messed up. You know, you think I wanted this to happen? I mean, he really got irritated about it as I talked to him there. And he said that she just didn't listen and she did not do a good thing. Now, I have also talked to someone else who has talked extensively with Allen, who says that she resented the way Mayor Williams and David Catania talked to her, that they talked down to her, that they didn't think she was they didn't treat her as if she was smart, and that she resented their approach to her campaign like she wasn't the candidate. She was just being told what to do. So here, just the bottom line, that campaign was a disaster from the beginning to its end.
Alyssa Silverman, you were the one who challenged the signatures that were gathered by S. Catherine Allen's campaign. What, in your estimation, went wrong?
Well, what went wrong is that the petitions were full of fraud and forgeries.
Why did you suspect that?
It was an interesting series of events, Kojo. I mean, let me say, as the incumbent, so I often am an out-of-the-box thinker, but when it came to a petition challenging, initially I wasn't. Incumbents generally don't challenge petitions because we see this often in district politics. An incumbent benefits from having a number of challengers. A few things happen. I want to give credit to Tracy Hughes. So Tracy Hughes had announced she was running against me, but she didn't turn in her petitions because she hired a firm, which we know is Strategies for Change, She found that the company had given her petition sheets that were full of similar handwriting she felt were full of forgeries and fraud. The reason why that caught my attention is because my campaign office is located in the U-Line Arena, where the Beatles had their first concert. It's also the office space for Strategies for Change. And I had encountered some of the petition gatherers for both Tracy Hughes and Catherine Allen. So when I heard what happened with Tracy, once again, I want to give Tracy credit for being a person of integrity and honesty, because one of the quirks of our this petition system is that the petitions are considered good until someone challenges them. I know that you guys have discussed this in prior weeks. So Tracy could have handed them in hoping that no one would challenge them. But once she did the right thing, I said, well, let me take a look at Catherine Allen's petitions, because I know that there were some of the same people had circulated for her, and it might have some of the same problems, and indeed, that was true.
So we can put the petition thing to bed. It was a disaster.
Yeah.
And no, if you're going to be a candidate in the District of Columbia, whether you like the petition system or not, it's pretty simple. You sign up, you get the petitions, you get them filled out accurately, and then you check them to make sure they're accurate, and then you turn them in. There are some, but in Maryland, being waved off by the...
Well, I don't know how to jump in. So I know that you said, Tom, that it's a pretty simple process, but I want to point out, because I remember you were the person who first reported the Williams petition issue in 2002. I remember it very clearly because I was Loose Lips at the time, and at that time the internet wasn't something in which newspapers knew how to use. And I remember you went right on the air, and I had to wait till Thursday to put that in the paper, so it's embedded in my memory. This was different than what happened to Mayor Williams, because in his petition sheets were people we knew who weren't district residents, like Donald Duck and Elton John and Kofi Annan. This kind of fraud was very duplicitous, because they were names of district voters. I mean,
they copied it from other lists.
They copied it. What we found, what we believe to have happened, is whoever did it copied it from petition sheets from the Democratic primary. And partially, Koja, what tipped me off as well is that names of my staff members were in there. My legislative director was in there twice. My chief of staff was in there twice. And many activists, political activists from our community.
It was a fraud. So right. How do we fix it?
Yes. Well, I think one thing to do is for citywide races where you have to hand in a number of signatures. In my race, the threshold is 3,000. I do believe the Board of Elections should proactively check the signatures.
Like Maryland.
Yes, because the burden is on the challenger to prove everything. And we have a system right now where you can hand in 2,999 fraudulent forgery signatures, but if you hand in 3,001 good ones, then the challenge doesn't move forward, and you can get on the ballot. I don't think that makes sense. You can send a letter of protest to the board, but we had to not only prove that there was forgery and fraud, and we got affidavits from numerous district residents to say this isn't my signature, but also we had to prove that she did not meet the threshold.
Well, Catherine Allen had raised more money than you because she had been getting money from the business community. The Washington Post called her ouster a devastating blow for the business establishment. Indeed, she was running on a pro-business platform, specifically took aim at you for your support of paid family leave, claiming that it cost Washingtonians too much. I have both a general and a specific question. How do you respond to critics who say that you are anti-business?
I don't think that's true and accurate at all, Kojo. On the issue of paid family leave, this has been a debate now for 3 years in our city. We're moving forward. It's the law. And we're one of only three countries in the world without some type of paid family leave national program. And in fact, many states are moving forward. California, of course, has had paid family leave for like 14 years now. And it has been seen to be a benefit to workers, to businesses, and to health issues as well, like infant mortality. issues. So I'm looking forward to the program. But I have been an ally of businesses across the city. One of the other issues that I have focused on, and I think people know that I have brought my sort of accountability tools to, is DCRA, the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs. So last night I was before the LGBT Chamber of Commerce, our regional chamber of commerce for LGBT businesses. And when I brought up DCRA, there are all kinds of hoots and hollers, Kojo, because that costs businesses real money. And when we can't get a permit completed, or there's a question about licensing, I can't get a license, or all kinds of issues that in our regulatory process that make it difficult to do business.
The main criticisms that have been made against the paid family leave legislation is that it helps more people who live outside of the district than it does district residents.
But, two-thirds.
But Tom mentioned earlier that another of your opponents in this race, Dion Reeder, who is a small business owner, she says that the 0.62% tax on employers like her, who runs a small business, is a strain on her business, and she argues that employees should pay a part of the tax. What's your view?
That's why we should be a state, Kojo. So the Constitution says that Congress has ultimate authority over the district, and in the Home Rule Charter, it specifically states that we can't tax commuters. So the idea that we could tax Maryland or Virginia residents and have them split the cost like in other states, we can't do because we're handicapped by Congress. But let me say, so Deanne spoke before the AFL-CIO. We had a candidate forum a few days ago. And Deanne said that her business was already in trouble. So paid family leave, we're still 8 months away from collecting the payroll tax, the employer contribution. So I think there might be other things that we should look at that might be impacting her business.
Tom Sherwood.
Dion Reeder, of course, when she got in the campaign last year, had expected Tony Williams, the former mayor, to endorse her. And we wrote about that in the city paper also, how she was surprised that he suddenly turned and went to Allen. But she did say paid family leave does seem to be the sticking issue about the financing of it. The chairman, Phil Mendelson, spent a year talking about how he was going to maybe alter the financing of it. He supported family leave, and for those people who don't know, it's 6 weeks of family leave, 8 weeks of parental leave, 6 weeks of family leave, and 2 weeks of medical leave for every 52-week period worked. But he couldn't figure out a way to change the financing. Are you open to ways to change the financing, or do you think you're already working with the employment office to set up this regulatory scheme of how it's going to be done? Or is this, as they like to say, settled law?
Well, we are implementing the law, and I'm interested in implementing the best paid family leave program that we can have. This has been a three-year discussion. For people who say that there wasn't an opportunity to weigh in or they wanted other options, I have not observed district politics as long as the two of you, but I'm in my third decade now, and I can say I can't.
You know,
think
that's just a way of her saying we're old, right? Okay, but go ahead.
Maybe you're in decade, just the other side of that decade, Kojo. But I can't remember. I would challenge both of you to think of a bill that has been debated longer than paid family leave. Right now, we are in the implementation. I think what we, instead of saying, well, let's, because Chairman Mendelson did say, well, let's consider alternatives, he couldn't find an alternative that worked. So let's move forward. Let's implement this. Right now, we are building the tax system so that we can collect the contributions, and that in July of 2020, workers in the District of Columbia can join the rest of the world in being able to spend time with their families and not feel it's going to put them in financial jeopardy.
Can we ask one more thing about paid family? Is it correct that the CFO of the city, the independent CFO, if that person decides that this is financially not doable, he can stop the process, or has he signed off on it?
Well, the CFO has signed off on it. Building the program as we speak right now, Tom. I think the issue is the reserve for the making sure that we have a healthy reserve or a healthy fund to pay the benefits out.
And if that doesn't happen, then you delay the benefits. Is that correct?
Well, I think the CFO has been very cautious and conservative to make sure that the tax rate will meet the benefits paid out. I actually think because the CFO is generally cautious and conservative, we might have more money in the fund and not as much money going out. And that would be a question of what to do.
Gary in Washington, D.C. wants to talk about one of the other issues that is of concern to the business community at large and the restaurant and bar community in particular. Here is Gary. Gary, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, how's it going? I was calling to ask about Councilwoman Silverman's position on Initiative 77 repeal. I mean, that thing passed by a pretty wide margin, and now the council's trying to get rid of that. Are they going to just overthrow the voters there? Does Councilwoman support that?
So thanks, Gary, for the question. This is going to be is a difficult issue that's coming before the council on Monday. I am not for the repeal bill that's been introduced, Gary, to be clear about that. I am for a compromise. It is a situation where I'm going to be pragmatic here in that there are seven council members who are signed on to a bill that would just repeal Initiative 77, that would ignore what voters decided and just get rid of it. I don't think that's the right thing to do, but I do think that we need to work with the restaurant industry, and I need to work with my colleagues to come up with something that's going to address why Initiative 77 came before voters, and I think why voters approved it. I think that the restaurant industry, and we know the hospitality industry, is an incredibly important. It's a tremendous employer in our city, and we need to keep it vibrant. We also need to make sure that workers are paid fairly and equitably. And that's why I think voters approved the initiative, is because they want to make sure that people who work in the restaurant industry in our city make a decent wage and can afford to live here. So I am going to use Monday's hearing, and I believe I read in the Washington Post right before we went on air that 240 people have signed up to testify. I would encourage people, if you want to weigh in like you, Gary, and you haven't signed up, submit testimony. I will read it. Because I'm going to be asking questions in the hearing about how people are paid in the restaurant industry, and to try to get at issues where we can find some compromise in this.
Thank you for your call, Gary.
You know, the council has overturned term limits before, and also people forget there was mandatory minimum sentencing that was very harsh on people. That passed an initiative, and that was overturned by the council, too. So whether you're for or against the subject matter, the council, under the authority, the way the home rule is set up, that initiatives do go, the council can act on them just like it can act on any other legislation. So it's not like they're coming out of left field. They should obviously consider the will of the voters, but it's not something that they are taking extraordinary steps to do.
This has been such a fascinating issue. I have to tell it to you, Vue. I've been occupied with other things this summer, but one of the things that I've done is spend a lot of time with restaurant owners and workers in our city. And the restaurant industry is really like no other industry in terms of how people are paid. And that's one of the things I'm interested in talking to restaurant owners and workers. For example, tipped employees in restaurants aren't just the server that that you as a customer are giving your tip to. There are other people like bussers and barbacks and food runners who also rely on that tip, not only as a gratuity, as a supplement, but you're actually paying the wage because of the way the wage structure is in the restaurant industry. And one of the things I am interested in is how those workers are paid. Here are a few things that we know. We know that wage theft, that restaurant workers are not always paid fairly, are not always given the pay that they deserve for the hours that they work. It's one of the industries in which we see this problem. And I am concerned that it might be not the servers who have been the voice of the anti-Initiative 77 movement, but maybe the people who I would consider like the secondary.
The back of the house.
Well, back of the house are hourly workers who are the cooks, but these are the people who receive their tips from other tipped employees. And like one of the interesting conversations I had with a restaurant, every restaurant owner I sit down with, I say, well, how do you pay your bussers? And one of the restaurant owners said, well, they receive between 5% and 10% of the server's tips. And I said, well, is it 5? Is it 10? How do they know it's not 2%? And that's what's interesting about this industry is there's really no regulation here. There's no universal way of distributing tips. Some people pool tips, some people don't.
We're running on limited time here. So what's the compromise you would be looking for?
Well, I'm not sure yet, Kojo. I am interested in looking at certain measures that the restaurants themselves have come before me. They say they're interested in this wage, in combating wage theft, making sure people are paid fairly, so like having anonymous tip lines, things like that. I also think we need to stabilize wages to make sure people can live
two,
in this city.
There are two other issues we need to get to, and we have a total of about 4.5 minutes
okay.
left. Tom Sherwood and a bunch of fat cats like him were at the Economic Club in Washington last night listening to Jeff Bezos speak. I'd like him to quickly set the scene and then ask you how you think about would you welcome Amazon headquarters here? But first,
one of the questions that David Rosenstein asking was is would you what's the status on Amazon coming to this region or anywhere? And he put everyone off again by saying by the end of the year we'll make an announcement. You know, he's the owner of the Washington Post, which has had terrible labor relations with its news organization. And I say that
says a former union representative.
I was going to say he's a former union rep for the newsroom for 2 years. But he was quite, I mean, he enraptured the crowd that was there, but it was mostly a business crowd. Amazon would, some people are saying he's going to, if he comes to Washington, he's going to come to all three jurisdictions. He's not just going to build one big, massive thing. What is your own concern? Even Mayor Bowser told me last night, well, if they choose us, I still have a lot of questions about how it will work. But where are you on Amazon and how it would affect housing and incomes and all that in the city?
Well, I think we need to prepare whether it happens or not.
It's like hurricane.
Well, we know exactly. Hurricane Amazon. Well, we know that there's going to be an impact on housing because if Amazon comes, and even if it comes to another
Arlington.
Jurisdiction, yes,
yeah.
Crystal City has been rumored in the press, I think, to be the top candidate. We know certain people, because the district's a great place to live, are going to want to live in the district. And I think right now, instead of waiting, which is one of the things that I think we do too much of, we wait to see what's going to happen. We should start strategizing. How are we going to deal with an influx of high-income workers coming? How are we going to prevent displacement? Let's start using things like DOPA and other affordable housing strategies. Let's be strategic instead of sort of waiting and seeing and then saying, oh my goodness, what happened?
Well, and just very quickly, Arlington has a horrible situation in terms of vacant commercial property. Something like 20% of the Arlington buildings are vacant, so they can move into Crystal City quite easily.
Here's the other issue you're interested in. Attorney General Carl Racine is suing Power Design, an electrical contractor that worked with the city for many high-profile construction projects, including the Line Hotel, over wage theft. But the D.C. Apprenticeship Council, which vets contractors, won't penalize the company. You're pushing for more oversight of the Apprenticeship Council. What exactly does the Apprenticeship Council do, and why do you think it needs more oversight?
So we have an apprenticeship law that when there are public projects, taxpayer dollars used for projects, that we should be training workers for the great jobs that are available in the both in the construction industry and the IT industry. It's once again, Kojo's, a place where we haven't been strategic enough in taking advantage of our economic development. The Apprenticeship Council, when these projects, these contractors come before them, they are there to approve apprenticeship programs to say that, yes, you have the right elements in place to train workers to become, you know, in the end, journeymen electricians or carpenters or plumbers. These are all jobs that we need in this city. And my problem with Power Design, and I really do want to thank Attorney General Racine for bringing forth this case. It gets back to what we talked about in the restaurant industry. We know wage theft is pervasive in the construction industry. People aren't being paid fairly. They're not paid what they deserve.
You don't think the Apprenticeship Council should be approving companies that apparently are
stealing wages from workers?
It should do its job based on what's in the law or what it's supposed to be doing. But you're out of time, but the summer jobs program, did it work well this year or not? Just very shortly.
I think the summer jobs program is a good program, and we always have room for improvement.
Alyssa Silverman is a council member at large. She's an independent in Washington running for re-election. And
that's it,
I know
Coach
that your
what?
Mom listens
Don't
to
be Jack Evans on us.
Your mom listens to this broadcast, and you mentioned that you've been hanging out in restaurants a lot. So I wonder if she's concerned about whether or not you're being nutritionally, if you're taking care of your nutrition by hanging around restaurants, if you're not preparing your own meals.
Oh, wow, Kojo. Well, next time she'll come in and answer that question.
Thank you both so much for joining us. Up next is Brian Frosch. He's the Attorney General of Maryland. If you have questions or comments for Brian Frosch, call us now. Tom Sherwood, very quickly, what's going on in the Commonwealth of Virginia over redistricting? The Democrats and the Republicans are at odds. The Democratic Attorney General is asking the court to go ahead and propose and to redraw the lines of their own. The Republicans said, no, we're not at an impasse. We can redraw the lines, even though they are appealing the court's decision that says that these 11 districts are unconstitutional.
Well, they're not at an impasse, but they are stuck. Both Governor Northam, the Democratic governor, and the Democratic attorney general.
What's the difference between being stuck and at an impasse?
Well, I want to make sure you're paying attention. Both said, look, we just told the court, you go ahead and do it. There's too much trouble. The legislature is too closely split to get this done. The Republicans say, no, we're still challenging the whole order to change these 11 districts in court. And House Speaker Kirk Cox just this week told the court, look, we will get this done by September 27th or some date like that. So this is we're talking about what will happen in the legislative districts in next year's state house elections, not anything this year.
Brian Frosch is the Attorney General of the state of Maryland. General Frosch, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kojo.
When we're talking about gerrymandering, we should also be including Maryland, because Maryland has gerrymandered districts also. What do you think should be done?
Well, I think it would be great if the Supreme Court could come up with a standard that applies across the country and that eliminated political gerrymandering. Of course, it's my job to defend the constitutionality of Maryland's laws, and we've done that, and so far successfully. But gerrymandering is a big problem, and the Supreme Court seems to be the only institution that can address it, and so far they've failed.
Good. Let's get right to you. Craig Wolf, your Republican opponent for Attorney General, was on the program sitting right where you are right now. And it was the last week or the week before.
Last week.
It just runs. He says that you are involved in too many national suits with other states against the Trump on a whole series of issues. Not that those aren't important issues, but he says, as the Attorney General of the state of Maryland, you really ought to be spending more time being the Attorney General for the state of Maryland and not going after all these national
Just focus
issues.
On Maryland issues.
Well, we are Your focusing. Answer. We are focusing on Maryland issues. And in my time in office, 3.5 years or so, we have recovered hundreds of millions of dollars for consumers and for the state from predatory lenders, Wall Street banks, tobacco companies, polluters. We've indicted and put behind bars some of the most dangerous people in our state. I'm talking about drug traffickers, human traffickers, violent gang members, pill mill operators. We shut down sham charities. We stand up for the people of Maryland over and over every single day. And part of that job includes protecting them from what's going on in Washington, D.C. I mean, yesterday we filed suit against the Trump administration again.
In an effort to protect the Affordable Care Act.
Exactly. And there are about 450,000 Marylanders who either get subsidies or have their insurance paid for by Medicaid in our state. Everybody else who has a pre-existing condition, and that's more than a million folks, has their health care jeopardized if the Affordable Care Act is destroyed, as Trump and Jeff Sessions
are trying to do. But one lawsuit that your opponent specifically pointed to as an example of alleged overreach is the Trump Hotel emoluments case. Hmm. He says, how does a hotel in D.C. affect the lives of Marylanders, and why have you taken on this case?
The emoluments clauses are our nation's original anti-corruption law. They're designed to ensure that the president puts our interests first, not his bottom line first. And what's going on here is Trump is receiving illegal payments from foreign countries, India, China, Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Indonesia, Malaysia, and many others. He gets them every day through the Trump Post Office Hotel. And let me tell you this one story.
Donald, make it short.
All right.
And make it affect Marylanders.
Well, it affects every single person in the United States because Donald Trump applied to get his name trademarked in China. China said no for 10 years. Trump campaigned saying he wasn't sure he was going to continue the One China policy. Finally, after he was elected on February 9th, 2017, he meets with President Xi of China and reaffirms our commitment to the One China policy. And 5 days later, China grants his trademarks. Now, is it just a coincidence? I don't know, but nobody in the country should have to ask that question.
I should mention that you have joined other attorney generals in these.
The attorney, Carl was seeing from D.C., says that the Democratic attorneys general, their offices talk once a week. Now, are you part of that, some of your staff at least, or somebody?
Somebody is often on those calls.
Okay. Now, Craig Wolf, have you said anything about your opponent other than disputing what he says about you? What do you think of Craig Wolf as your opponent? What have you said about him, why people should vote for you and not him? Is there anything?
Well, I talk about what we've done.
Any criticisms at all of Craig Wolf? He's 18 years or whatever it is in the liquor industry.
Well,
or?
He has been a liquor lobbyist on Capitol Hill for the past 18 years. I don't think that's disqualifying. But
but you haven't really engaged him on something on any qualifications he has or doesn't have.
No, I mean I think my record stands.
Don't ruin the political politics hour by not saying anything.
Be debating him. Will you be debating him?
Okay.
You will
yes.
be debating him.
Right.
Okay.
Can we run through some quick issues? You've
yes,
been urged.
Sure.
The Catholic Church is in turmoil. You've been urged by some read to investigate the Catholic Church in Maryland, just as Pennsylvania and other places have. Your policy is not to discuss open or shut cases or things you might be doing, but can you give people any guidance or your own concerns about what's happening in the Catholic Church?
Yes. What we saw in the Pennsylvania report was horrific, and we have set up, if you go to our webpage, you will see a link right on the front page to victims of child sexual abuse, and there is a reporting. If you click that link, you'll bring up a reporting
form. Is that
form.
New, or has that been around for a while?
It's been there just about since the Pennsylvania report.
Oh, really? So it is fairly new then. Okay.
Yes. That's and well, I mean, normally isolated incidents of child sexual abuse are the province, the jurisdiction of the local prosecutors, our state's attorneys. But we have begun to receive complaints, reports, et cetera. We are looking at all of those carefully, but I cannot confirm or deny that we're engaged in an investigation of anyone or any individual or any institution.
Well, I think you've made news. I haven't heard that before.
Nick in Baltimore wants to know if you're willing to come. Well, I'll have Nick ask you himself. Nick, go ahead, please.
You pretty much asked my question already, but would you be willing to investigate the Archdiocese of Washington, the Archdiocese of Baltimore, the Diocese of Wilmington, and complaints, and to do an investigation akin to what was done in Pennsylvania?
If we were privy to information similar to the information that was disclosed by the Pennsylvania Attorney General's report, we would certainly consider an investigation of any entity that engaged in those kind of practices.
I want to ask you about Ben Jealous challenging Larry Hogan, the incumbent Republican governor.
And several people want to ask about that. Allow me to add to whatever Tom is saying. Ask Brian Frosch why he thinks it's so important to elect Ben Jealous. You, of course, supported Rashaan Breaker in the Democratic primary.
I did. I think that Ben Jealous is an excellent candidate. I think he'll be a fine governor. I think that we're engaged in a struggle for our country, and the struggle is with the current administration in Washington. I think Ben Jealous will help our effort to stop Donald Trump from tearing down our environmental protections, from tearing down our health protections, from right now Betsy DeVos is standing up for private for-profit institutions at the expense of vulnerable students that they've cheated. We could use help from the administration in Maryland to support those efforts, and I know Ben Jealous will provide it.
Now, what about the Trump effect? There are some people saying that that Ben Jealous's campaign is more nationally focused. I mean, he's talked about a variety of state issues, but the Democrats really are hoping for the disgust with Trump to help bring Democrats to the polls. Beyond the campaign itself, do you sense enough that the Democrats, like in other states, are going to turn out in record numbers because of Donald Trump, and that's why it's okay to make it kind of a national campaign?
Are you talking about my campaign?
No, not your campaign. You seem to be, I won't talk about your campaign, but no, in the Jealous campaign, Hogan has, as I've said on this program, has wrapped himself in bubble wrap to avoid being connected to Trump. But the feeling about Trump is energizing Democratic voters in many states, not just here. So how important is that, do you think, in terms of turnout? Because you need a good turnout in order to beat Larry Hogan, who does well in the polls.
I think that's right. And I suppose that's not something that my campaign is focusing on. But if I were Ben Jealous, I think I'd be doing everything I could possibly do to energize the electorate and drive up Democratic turnout.
In her email asking you why you thought it was important to support Ben Jealous, Donna also added, "Governor Hogan is always called popular because he's a do-nothing governor. When has he protected us against Trump? And also now he's planning to widen Route 270 and have a $41 one-way fee instead of investing more and in more and better mass transportation." Is that a sentiment you share?
Well, I certainly think the state should be investing in mass transit. I think it was a mistake to cancel the Red Line in Baltimore City. I think the future of transportation is not widening roads. I mean, we saw that with 270 back in the 1970s and 80s. They invested massively to widen it. They thought that the widening would alleviate traffic for 15 years. It was 2.5 to 3 years before traffic was back up to its horrible levels, and it's only gotten worse since. If you increase the supply, demand will rise to meet it, and that's what goes on when you widen roads.
Are you participating in any of the county executive races? There are some interesting races in Baltimore County and Prince George's County, Montgomery County. Have you made any endorsements there that I should have heard about?
I support all of the Democratic candidates in all of those races. It's
well,
an easy
well
pick.
In Montgomery County, that's a serious issue because Nancy Florine, who is a lifelong Democrat,
an ex-Democrat,
is challenging Mark Elrich in that county, and Robin Ficker's running, and that's a very interesting campaign. Will you try to help Mark in any way, Mark Elrich?
Yes, I support Mark. I think he's been an outstanding county council member, and he has a breadth of knowledge that's unequaled about how the county works. He's a very smart guy and works collaboratively, and I think he'll be a great county executive.
Are you worried about a split vote or electing Robin Ficker?
Not really. I mean, I think, you know, Robin Ficker has run for office just about every 2 years for the past 30 years, and the electorate has been pretty smart figured out that after one term in the House of Delegates, he was not the kind of public official they wanted to have in office.
This is more, I guess, in your area. Ben Jealous has a progressive criminal justice plan that includes reducing the prison population by 30% and legalizing marijuana for adult recreational use. What do you make of these proposed changes?
Well, look, I'm now the chief law enforcement officer in the state. I think that Maryland does need to take steps to reduce the prison population. I was a prime mover of the effort to change our bail system, our pretrial justice system, because we had thousands of poor people in jail because they'd been charged with minor crimes and couldn't afford the small amounts of bail that had been set for them. That has reduced the jail population significantly. I think we can make much more progress in that area by funding the local jurisdictions to have robust pretrial assessment systems. I think that's a very fruitful area, and I haven't had an opportunity to talk to Ben and find out exactly what he has in mind above and beyond that, but I can tell you that would be very productive.
But there is the prison population has gone down in part for the things the state has done.
Yes, the Justice
Already
Reinvestment Act,
right,
and the reform of pretrial have had an impact.
You've had mostly to work with the Republican governor you've had to work with the Republican governor in a mostly Democratic state. What difference would it make in the way you work? How would it change the way you work if a progressive Democrat were to be elected governor like Ben Jealous?
Well, our office can use help in a series of areas. We asked, for example, for two more people for our criminal division to help fight the opioid crisis, and we didn't get them. The General Assembly mandated that our office get $1 million to use the Maryland Defense Act, and we got nothing. And if there were a Democratic governor, I'm pretty sure that we would get those resources, and I think that would be very helpful.
The legislature is thinking about taking the alcoholic beverage control matters away from Controller Peter Franchot, another Democrat who I guess you support, right? So what do you think about that? This is a big industry. You know, he's been fighting the battle for craft breweries. Virginia's touting how its craft brewery business is growing. North Carolina is. Maryland, Peter Franchot says the big boys are blocking this industry from blossoming in Maryland. Do you have any views on this and alcohol enforcement in general?
I don't. You know, we don't have a dog in that fight. It's a policy question for the General Assembly, and I'm content to leave it up to them. I think they can work it out with Comptroller Franchot.
What about Airbnb? Airbnb enforcement. There's jurisdictions around are worried about these miniature hotels that are opening around the state. Is there a state role in that? It's very popular in this region.
You know, it's mostly a local issue, mostly zoning, decided by the county councils around the
Not
state.
Not a state.
Hasn't been so far.
The opioid crisis. You announced charges this week against the drug manufacturer Insys Therapeutics, attempting to hold it responsible for some of the spread of the drugs. Why did you take them on? What were they doing?
So I have to confine myself to what we've said in the complaint, but what we allege is the following. They were selling a drug called Subsys. It's a fentanyl-based quick-release drug. It's extremely addictive. It's approved by the FDA only for breakthrough cancer pain where no other opioid can give relief to the patient. We allege that Insys engaged in a course of conduct to pay doctors to prescribe Subsys, and they prescribed it for back pain, for headaches, for knee pain, and we allege that 90% of the prescriptions for Subsys were not for breakthrough cancer pain. And there was a wave of addiction and death that followed these very, very bad practices.
We only have time for one more, and it's Mark in Silver Spring, Maryland. Mark, your turn.
I'll be quick. Good afternoon, Mr. Attorney General. I want to support you in defending the ACA. One, in terms of Medicaid expansion, when you compare the states that had expansion with 32 states, only three had a majority of their counties with only one insurer in the beginning of 2017, while the 19 without Medicaid expansion, 11 or 58% had a majority of their counties with only one insurer. So Medicaid expansion not only provides critical health care services, it's a bulwark in supporting the health insurance marketplace.
Glad you said you'll be brief. What's your question?
Okay. I'm providing critical information for the Attorney General on...
Well, allow me to have him respond.
Okay. Well, Mark, I agree with you. The Affordable Care Act has helped hundreds of thousands of Marylanders, millions of people across the country. The the fact that we have expanded Medicaid and that we have subsidized health insurance for other folks gives health insurance to about 450,000 Marylanders. All the rest of us who have pre-existing conditions have saved money, gotten better health care as a result of the Affordable Care Act, and it's extremely important to Maryland. We're going to defend
it. Do I have time for immigration?
30 seconds.
Immigration. Anything new? You've been a leader on immigration and suits. Anything new on immigration and the treatment of undocumented people?
Of course, we were among the AGs that sued the Trump administration for tearing kids away from their parents. The court has enjoined that and required them to reunite the families. And so far, the Trump administration has not been able to unscramble its rotten egg. We are going to continue to keep pressure on them to do that. It's the most inhumane act that I can
Brian
remember.
Brian Frosch is the Attorney General of Maryland up for re-election. Thank you for joining us. That's it for today's show. Check out our website, kojoshow.org, for some of the coverage we did this week on education, including a conversation with Alexandria's superintendent, a look at how school systems figure out which holidays to take off, and a segment on condoms in local schools. Thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
The Kojo Nnamdi Show is produced by Ingalisa Schroepsdorf, Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, and Lauren Marco. Our engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at kojoshow.org.
Thanks for listening to the Kojo Nnamdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.